It is a privilege to be here, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great Zen master, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on his teachings, passing on the meaning of the teachings of all the great ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni. For the final talk in this series on the Sandokai lectures that Suzuki Roshi gave during the summer session at Tassajara the year before he died, I'd like to talk about Tassajara. And for Tassajara, read serious Zen practice. But it could be anywhere. But as Roshi says, we need to read the back of the paper, not just the printed characters, but the other side of the page, the big Dharma world behind what we're always doing. Those are my words. That's what he means by the other side of the page. And this is what goes on at Tassajara. We're reading the other side of the page. Roshi says, I don't know why I'm a Tassajara. It's not for you or myself or even for Buddha or Buddhism. I am just here. But when I think I have to leave Tassajara in 2 or 3 weeks, I don't feel so good. I don't know why. I don't think it's just because you were my students. I don't have any particular person whom I love so much. I don't know why I have to be here. It's not because I'm attached to Tassajara. I'm not expecting anything in the future in terms of a big monastery or Buddhism, but I don't want to live up in the air. I want to be right here. I want to stand on my feet. This, I don't know why I have to be here. It was a feeling that haunted me. Everything about Zen practice from the very beginning felt very difficult and yet absolutely necessary. There simply was no choice. I never missed showing up morning and evening from the first day I went to the Berkeley Zendo. Getting from, I don't know why I have to be here, to I am just here, I think is a true Zen Buddhist accomplishment. Roshi says more. The only way to stand on my feet when I am at Tassajara is to sit. That is the reason I'm here. To stand on my feet and to sit on my black cushion are the most important things for me. I don't trust anything but my feet and my black cushion. They are my friends always. My feet are always my friends. When I'm in bed, my bed is my friend. There's no Buddha, no Buddhism, no Zazen. When I am really standing on my feet, I am not lost. For me, this is nirvana. There's no need to travel to cross mountains or rivers. I am right here in the Dharma world. So I have no difficulty crossing mountains and rivers. This mountains and rivers is about the interconnectedness of all beings. And this is how we don't waste time. Moment after moment, we should live right here without sacrificing this moment for the future. And then he talks a little about how practice and enlightenment are like a cart and a horse. So if you do actual physical practice, that's the same as enlightenment. And we call practice based on enlightenment, real practice that has no end. and we call enlightenment that starts with practice and is one with practice, beginningless enlightenment. Dogen makes a distinction between this, what I just said, and self-centered practice, where practice and enlightenment are events that we encounter in our life. We do practice and later we attain enlightenment, or maybe. But when we realize that, this is Dogen now, when we realize that practice and enlightenment, when we realize them as events that appear in the realm of the great Dharma world, then enlightenment is an event that expresses the Dharma world, and practice is also an event that expresses the Dharma world. And so if both suggests the big Dharma world, there's actually no need to be discouraged if we don't attain enlightenment, nor should we be extremely happy if we do. Practice and enlightenment have equal value. Now, you may wonder if everyone's, you know, practice and enlightenment are the same and have equal value, then what is attaining enlightenment? You know, we hear this all the time about attaining enlightenment. Well, I thought practice, you know, I'm practicing and I thought they were the same. And this is me talking and I could be wrong, but I think it's attaining the consciousness of enlightenment. When you're practicing sincerely, enlightenment is there, but you're not aware of it. And awareness arises in a moment of practice realizing itself. That's all. That's my understanding. Awareness arises in a moment of practice realizing itself. That's all. So a student asks Roshi, Roshi, do you think we have any choice? For instance, am I here at Tassajara by my choice, or am I simply at Tassajara? And Roshi says, your Buddha nature brought you here to Tassajara. I don't think it was your choice completely. Maybe 20 or 30% is your choice. But most of the reason for your being here is beyond that. That we hear Buddha's teaching, and this is you, by the way, right now, this applies to you. You're hearing Buddha's teaching. The best I can do, you're hearing Buddha's teaching. So when we hear Buddha's teaching, it's because of our previous study. This is Roshi now. Wisdom seeks wisdom. And we are listening to the teaching that we have listened to under many teachers in past lives. Dogen says this, even though you feel as if your whole body is saying, I am feeling this way 100%, that voice that now seems to cover all of your being actually is only a little tiny part of you. And Roshi says, maybe I shouldn't explain so much in the traditional way. So the upshot of that part was your Buddha nature brought you here to Tassajara, and the feeling that you did it is maybe 20, 30% your choice. So the student says, well then, if I were to become a Buddha, would I have anything to do with it? And Roshi says, first of all, try to forget yourself and rely on your true voice, your voiceless voice, your nonverbal voice. Listen to the tongueless teaching, we say. Don't listen to my words. This is the same as we need to read the back of the paper, not just the printed characters, but the other side of the page. This is the same as listening to the tongueless teachings. If you do things not because of Buddha or truth or yourself or others, but for the things themselves, that is the true way. And this is probably the most important point today. If you do things not because of Buddha or truth or yourself or others, but for the things themselves, that is the true way. And what's so important is this spinning of you around to face the present and not the future. But we've been taught just the opposite, to do things because of Buddha or because of the truth or because of ourselves or because of our gaining ideas. We don't think to do zazen for zazen or to clean to make things feel they've been taken care of. Maybe that's why I don't know why I have to be here. It can haunt me. But I am just here bypasses the whole issue. Another student says, Roshi, I may put my palms together in gassho, and someone may look at me and say, oh, that's a good gassho, but there may be a cold heart behind it. And Roshi says, cold heart or warm heart is not the question. The student, is it still a good gassho? Roshi, perfect. Perfect means that a gassho is just a gassho. It's done for itself and it's complete and perfect in itself. It's a form, and the student, by performing the form, made the appropriate response. Remember when Buddha was, we've talked about this, when Buddha was asked, how do you boil down Buddhism to one sentence thing? And he said, an appropriate response. That's why the student's feelings are irrelevant. We just show up for zazen when the bell rings. It doesn't matter how we feel about it. That's why practice is important. The importance is the mirror that anything you do in a practice mind shines on your mind. So you get to see your mind. Oh, I did my gassho, but I had a cold heart. You get to see that because it's practice. Because at Tassajara, whenever you pass anybody, you gassho. And you just do that. It doesn't matter how you feel. So I bowed, but my heart was cold. That is practice itself. That's exactly what practice is made of. So I hope you're understanding that practice, like the rules from last week, when we talked about the rules, how the form catches the truth behind it. The form that we talked about, the rules, catches the truth behind them. And the same thing happens with practice. Practice, which can feel like a rule, catches the truth behind it. So now I would like to read from a memoir that I wrote about myself up until I left Zen Center. And like the diary of Isa that I read last week, it's in the form of a haibun, which is prose and then a haiku. And it's this passage that I want to read to you is at the very end of the book, and it's about why I left Tassajara and found Buddha's way in the form of yes practice. I want to caution you not to polarize. You may think that I don't know why I have to be here is not yes practice. But actually, there's a huge yes behind it. Otherwise, I would not be here. And that yes is very strong, like dynamite, really. And it has a big Dharma world feel to it. But when I said yes to poetry as a way, I got to, I am just here. It's the same, only more subtle. I wish I could explain it better. What is yes practice? It is doing what you say yes to with your whole body and mind. Where does yes abide? It abides in the big Dharma world. How do you know? How do you know what yes? How do you know your yes? Can you fake it? Maybe something looks attractive and I think I'm saying yes to it. You know by the joyful, exuberant effort that arises of itself. Faking isn't possible. Is yes practice easier than zazen? No. The key yes practice support, so the key yes practice support is source or original nature. In silence and stillness, it lives, and you will hear it when your silence and stillness matches it. I want to say that again. In silence and stillness, it lives, and you will hear it when your silence and stillness matches it. Reb Anderson Roshi tells a story of a Zen teacher whose sleep kept being disturbed by a rat that was gnawing and scratching on the ceiling. And rats apparently, like hummingbirds, have a very fast metabolism. So it was breathing very rapidly and kept the man up. So he listened and attuned his breath to the rat's breath. And when he united with the rat's breathing, then he gradually slowed his breath to his normal breathing rate, and the rat's breath slowed down with him, and pretty soon the rat fell asleep. And that's what I mean by matches it. That's what I mean by matches it. When in silence and stillness, when your silence and stillness matches the silence and stillness of your original nature. I think that in reading Haibun aloud, I'm sorry that I don't think the haiku part really makes it sometimes, but I want to read it anyway because it actually does sometimes say in just a few words the gist of the passage in prose. So this is book four called Sky, and it's the tail end of Moon of the Swaying Buds. Rain warms the mountain air and feels soothing as it softly falls through the moonlight. Shallow drafts brush my face. Whereas minutes ago, I felt reluctant, tired, mean, suddenly I am overcome with gratitude. In the Zendo, I sit bolt upright, supported by the gurgling creek. A chorus of birds are so ardently chirping that there seems to be a wall of raspy, but sweet, wet life surrounding me on all sides. Drizzly day darts and wiggles in the waterweed. Chop, chop, chop. The carrot is now a row of paper-thin salad-ready. They're too skinny for soup or mixed vegetables slices. I am momentarily in control. Chopping block, hocho, which is a knife, and me standing, cutting the decisive widths. I feel exhausted, but the wafer slice carrot wheels are perfect. Basho, your rainproof paper hat made with your own hands, the one imitating Saigyo's? I too have felt desperately alone. At Tassajara, it rains. I have told the Tenkan I am sick and to please bring me hot water in a thermos later after breakfast. From my bed, I hear the rain softly falling and the sound lulls me back to sleep. A band of moonlight crisscrosses my otherwise darkened cabin. Cooling the night with its plashing, I doze, dreaming of its plashing. Sometimes the wake-up bell will ring with its primitive and unmistakably firm ring, and I cannot get out of bed. I lay there in the dark, in the glorious warmth of my sleeping bag, feeling remote, reluctant to decide to be at this monastery. The desire to stay in bed, finally to sleep enough, to be warm, to reconsider my life, is overwhelming. Hatched, but slow to uncoil in the mild rain. Through this sickness, my life emerges. First, I get that I'm sick, the vast extent of it. Then I recognize the tremendous energy that I bestow on things I choose to do. I can't help but ask why I pour myself into sewing, for example, and sneak out of Zazen, when it is Zazen I have presumably come to Tassajara to practice. Full moon, facing it, knees braced beneath my robe. The answer is evident in my hands. My hands write and sew with immaculate, single-minded passion, passion that is sure of itself, pulsating and elastic. In the Zendo, my hands freeze. All the contraptions I can devise to insulate them beneath my robes cannot prevent their stiffening numbness. Winds howl, snow mounts, the wintry thicket lifeless. One holds out for so long, then gives oneself over to a chain of events by which isolated segments of one's life unravel. The contents scramble, the life force renewed, released, slowly reconstructs itself as if one's karma metastasizes. Autumn leaves lie quietly in the sun. One day, I have the following thought. I have spent 11 years as a Zen student, resisting everything. What would happen if I take all the energy that I put into resisting and use it for something positive? Eaglet, ripping the soldier free from the asphalt. From this seed, I develop yes practice. Yes practice means doing only those things that I say yes to with my whole body and mind. I will not get out of bed until there is something I want that much. I have to find out if there is. If there isn't, I will just die, but I'm not going to pretend for another second. Shrouded in fog, a tiny dinosaur inches toward dawn. Soon it occurs to me that I want to write. Whereas formerly, I felt I needed a specified subject. Now I think, if I want to write, I'm going to write. I'm going to write a certain number of hours a day, just like I go to Zazen, a certain number of hours a day. I will not worry about what I write. I will concern myself solely with attending my writing periods. High noon, lime green sulfurs, mud puddle in the canyon dust. I am through with Zen Center. I need to define my own regime. Zen Center has had it with me anyway. I am told privately that unless my attitude changes, I will not be accepted for fall practice period. Indeed, my attitude has changed, but not in the direction that would pique my interest in fall practice period. After the storm, over the hill, zigzagging. Saying yes, finally, was like a birth. And like most other births, it came after a long period of gestation, characterized by saying no, only the no was unconscious. Immersed in the fog of my unconscious no, I failed to recognize my own authenticity. Tadpoles, bug-eyed and squirmy in their bracken-shaded mud. A predominant feature of this inauthenticity was a sense of impending doom. Initially, it hovered around the dreaded, unnamed, seemingly unavoidable crisis one could feel swelling in my childhood household. The atmosphere of this swelling, forces at work that I didn't understand, the largeness of those forces, that they were way, way beyond me, my ensuing inertia and blankness, and the resulting compliance being a form of inertia, infiltrated all my subsequent endeavors until yes practice broke through the gridlock. Warming earth, its scent in an early spring breeze. Likewise, in college, my inability to think and to write perpetuated the sense of being stalked, that at any moment, something cataclysmic might happen because I couldn't keep up. A falcon circles ever more narrowly down through the desolate sky. Determining to say yes, making that a conscious act, housing the bits of emptiness and despair that belong to me, and then offering them to the universe. Yes practice meant claiming my life. Yes practice was the beginning of living my life as opposed to an ersatz life. Waving long legs, dragging itself through the widening split in the pre-dawn light. Buddhism, also an attempt to heal the unpin-downable sense of vacuousness that pervaded my life, turned out to be another trap. I began sitting Zazen because I had come to the end of a way of life to which my parents had brought me up. I needed a deeper path, to access a larger part of myself. I didn't know what this meant exactly. It wasn't formulated mentally. I was drawn to Zazen, however, at an important turning point. From broken shell to clump of blue stem, making a dash for it. I tried very hard to follow the schedule because I believed that I had finally found, consummate and unfathomable, a path that plumbed the core of my being. Despite the fact that it was difficult, I told myself that at least I was on the right track. If I could just exert a little more effort, a little more will, a little more self-discipline, flat pink sea, saffron wings flutter over the prawn boat. Ironically, the vehemence behind my determination hooked me irretrievably into another tailspin. I can't do it, and there's no other choice. As I focused my energy on adjusting to the community, this I was assured over and over, this is Zen practice. Just follow the schedule, everyone said, while you notice mentally the obstacles that arise for you. I failed to notice my unmitigated sense of hollowness and despair. Slipping on the scree, her wings smeared, my fingers powdery. The milieu of yes practice is movement. It includes ever-changing me, doing only those things that I say yes to with my whole body and mind, releases me minute by minute to become who I am. From the prow of the ferry, watching them spin ever faster over the bay. After I formally left Zen Center, I moved into a neighborhood apartment and for a while continued to sit Zazen. One day, I had an interview with the head monk, that was Reb. He asked about my leave-taking, and I carefully explained yes practice. He said to me, "Until you say yes, you cannot practice Buddhism." An Arctic basks, wings tilted toward the salmon pink sky. That's all. I wonder if there are some questions.
Thank you, Gail. The first question that we have is, yes, practice sounds really intriguing, but what is to prevent just doing whatever you want? I could see myself getting scattered very fast and never really finding my real yes.
Yes practice is extremely intentional, and though personal, it rests in the connection with the big Dharma world. So if you're a monk, you have said yes to living in a community with a schedule, and the schedule tells you exactly what to do every single second, almost. And so you may have complaints, but your life is on track of a large yes. So you've said yes to a larger yes. And so there's, you don't have, it's, so it's easier. It's easier for you. It's easier to be a monk with this. Lay people have to say, what am I doing? You know, what are we doing in this world? And you need to pull the truth from what arises, like a musician pulls the tune, the dominant melody from the tune that she's playing. It's a skill that you'll enjoy developing if you're conscientious. That's all.
The next one is, I think most people are spending their time in vain. No, I'm always busy, they may say, but if they say so, it is a sure sign that they are spending their time in vain. What does Roshi mean by this?
Someone once asked him, and he said it means don't goof off. So really, there's only one way to not spend your time in vain, and that is like a mule or an ass, just follow along what your life brings to you minute after minute. That's not to say that you don't have a larger idea about your life. But the key point, and this is the key ethical value in Buddhism, is gain and loss. That there isn't any gain and loss in your behavior. There's no thought of that, because the reason it's emphasized so much is that that thought separates you from what you're doing. So you're thinking about, oh, if I do this, da da da, and not just doing this. And so each thing in Buddhism, it's said that each thing has its own value. So you do zazen for the sake of zazen. You clean so that each thing will feel that they've been taken care of. I don't know if you know the story of Milarepa. So I don't remember his exact background, but it had something to do with his mother and his mother having been deceived, and maybe all her I think it was by a relative, and her possessions were all stolen. I don't remember the details, but he got furious. And so Milarepa became a student of Marpa. And Marpa is the man, the very great, supremely great being who walked the secret teachings from India to Tibet. He walked the secret teachings from India to Tibet. And he must have walked to India originally from Tibet. So two ways. And he, when Milarepa came to him, he saw whatever this was, let's say anger, he saw the tumultuousness of this feeling. And he told Milarepa to build him a tower. And so let's just say it was bricks. So I'm sure it wasn't, it's probably stones. So stone by stone, Milarepa builds this tower. And then as soon as he finishes it, Marpa says, oh, you know, tear that down. I think I want it over here. And so then Milarepa tears it down and he builds it back over. And Marpa does it again and again and again, years and years. And by the end, Milarepa learns that there's no accomplishing anything. You know, the only thing to do is pay close attention to how you put this brick down. And then you put that brick right over it. And that's the event. And there is no other event. And so, of course, now Milarepa is one of the all-time greatest saints ever in existence. He had all that ego stuff pounded out of him by the wisdom of Marpa. That is an exquisite example of practice. That's all. So, and what I guess the question had to do, Roshi's saying, don't waste your time. You're wasting your time when you don't have the attitude of staying focused on this minute. Okay, I just wanted to make that connection.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, I do not hear references to friends you made at Dasahara. Were close relationships discouraged? Did you remain in contact with anyone?
That's a really good question. You know, here's the real answer. The real answer is, see, I was so exhausted. I need about 9 1/4 hours of sleep. And at Tassahara, you get 6 3/4 hours. I was so exhausted that I couldn't think about it. All I thought about was sleep. And so after Zazen was over in the evening, you know, run, not walk, to your sleeping bag. And that's the end of it. But all the other people were having rendezvous with each other. I mean, there were many couples that were happening after Zazen was over. So you're hearing this story from, you know, a basket case kind of. If I could just get 6 hours and 46 minutes instead of 6 hours and 45, you know, I would do anything for that, just anything, just forget everything else. And so I wasn't in a state of thinking about other people. And, you know, in hindsight, I hardly made any friends at Zen Center. I think it was because it just wasn't my community. I made one friend in the beginning, and she was one of the women I later understood that Baker Roshi sort of went after sexually. And so she quickly, very soon after we established a really good friendship, she became a student of Trungpa Rinpoche in Boulder. So I had the feeling Roshi sent her there just because if she stayed, it was gonna be a problem. Her name was Gail too, actually. You know, I hardly made any friends. Yeah, I didn't have, I didn't have the energy or time. The schedule was really demanding, but everyone else did. Everyone else did, and it wasn't as demanding for them because they just, maybe they didn't need as much sleep or whatever. But thank you for asking. Zen Center was a hotbed. after Zazen was over. I should just tell you that.
Super interesting. Okay, so the next question we have is, you mentioned that Roshi said that wisdom seeks wisdom and that we are listening to teachings that we've heard in past lives. And that Dogen also says this, I have a hard time consolidating the idea of past lives with the idea that the self is an illusion. To me, the idea that the self is an illusion seems more plausible and fits better with other Buddhist teachings. But when I hear that such masters believe in past lives, I wonder if I'm missing some understanding. Is there a way to think about past lives that makes more sense alongside the idea of no self?
I'm glad you asked. I know that there are people who have a lot of trouble with reincarnation, the idea of reincarnation. As you can see, even Dogen, it's a fundamental concept in Buddhism. And I personally find it very helpful. And I'll tell you how. And I will answer your question also. It means that the more I sharpen and make more subtle my consciousness in this lifetime, the more, and then it's carried over. I start the next lifetime with this consciousness. So then it makes me feel like the more I can deepen my understanding, the more likely that in the next incarnation, I may get even deeper understanding. And the deeper one's understanding, the more you can help other people. So it isn't just for, oh, I want to have the best understanding. It's that the best place to be to help massive other people is enlightenment. And because then energetically, it's all mind. It's all mind to mind. And that's why it's so important. The thing about no self is that everything is interconnected. So we can't find any individual independent self, because there's this net of interconnection. But the net of interconnection also rises and falls. It ebbs and flows, and there's birth and death. But don't forget, there's also the other side of it, is there is no birth and death. There's no you, there's no me. And I'm not sure where mind stands in that, whether there's mind. I'm not sure. I think there's still mind. I can be wrong. So there's no self because of the interconnectedness. There's no way to find an individual self. But there is an ongoing energetic continuation. And I think that's through the mind. That's the best I can do for an answer. You're not alone by having trouble with the idea of incarnation. But as I said, for me, I just think it's, I don't know what I'd do without that idea. Because I'd feel like, well, everything I'm doing is, I don't know why it would feel it was, you know, it wasn't going to serve anything. I wish I could answer better.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, why is the appropriate response the core of Buddhist practice?
To make the appropriate response requires enormous spiritual development. There's no fixed rule because every single circumstance is different. So there's no saying, well, when this happens, do that. There's, because every circumstance, there's amalgam, there's a whole amalgam of issues. And so and every circumstance then requires generosity, ethics, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom, which are the six perfections. They're the six behaviors that are completely pure and have no, we call it no outflow. There's no leftovers from those six behaviors. So to embody them in their fullest is embodying the big Dharma world where the appropriate response arises of itself. So basically, to make the appropriate response, that is, to be the vessel for an appropriate response to arise of itself, requires enormous spiritual development. We'll talk about the paramitas. They're very, very important. And I was thinking after the next series on the precepts, which are the gateway to Zen, we could talk about the paramitas in the next one after that, which are the crux of development. They're the crux. They're what we're looking for in our development. Generosity, right ethics, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. That's all.
Gil, next question is, when Roshi says, moment after moment, we should live right here without sacrificing this moment for the future, is he saying not to make plans for the future? That doesn't seem smart.
We have to have a trajectory for our lives. We all need that. But from that trajectory, that's how we'll know what to do moment after moment. It's sort of like if you're writing a book, you need to know the voice of the book. Otherwise, you don't know what to edit for. And so in the same way, you need to know the voice of your life. Otherwise, you don't know what to do minute by minute. So that once that's in place, then that's what you do. Then you focus minute by minute on that. he's not. So the answer to your question is Roshi isn't saying don't make plans for your future. He's saying within that trajectory, focus very, let each thing that you do realize itself, and that you're only doing that one thing. It seems like even in food preparation, it said that the deliciousness of the food depends on the tranquility, capital T, of the mind of the chef. So it's our mind and the tranquility that we want to do each thing with. So if you say you're busy, it's a sign that you're probably not. You're probably not wasting time. Well, that you probably are wasting time, and that also you're having the wrong kind of presence in your activities. That's what Roshi means. That's all.
Gil, the last question that we have is that I don't know why I have to be here. I too have that feeling often. Roshi in the end did know why. He wanted to stand on his feet, and he said, the only way to stand on my feet when I'm at Tasahara is to sit. He said that sitting is the only thing he trusts. Is the secret then to find what you trust?
I don't know, because I definitely trusted Zen Buddhism, and I still had that feeling. I don't know why I have to be here. But in the end, it wasn't really Zen Buddhism at all that I left, as you can see. it was community practice. And community practice is considered extremely important in Zen practice. So it's sort of like if you're off on your own, you're just not taken seriously. But I just felt like leaving the community was leaving Zen, really. But in the end, I made my own community and my own monastery. And you can do that with one other person, it turns out. So the point is that not saying yes for the whole 11 years had enormous intelligence behind it. And pushing everything away was like trying to practice with my hands tied behind my back. But I never left practice. I took on even more because I came to understand through the resistance who I am. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. We're right on time, but for some people who joined a little late, I'd like to share that this is the last talk from our Karan series. We will start after 2 weeks on 11th of July. Please look out for an email from us with the registration link for next series of talks. Meanwhile, if you will have any questions, please feel free to reach out through email. That will be all.
Thank you so much for being here. And I'll see you in a few weeks.